Good afternoon. And I do want to say thank you to the Philadelphia Society and especially to my father, Bill Campbell, who has invited me to speak today. I told the scholarship orientation yesterday that I've been coming to this meeting for decades, and it's true. And so it's an honor to be asked to speak. What I'm going to say today is not something new or strikingly original. It's actually something that I think 40 years ago wouldn't have needed to be said at all, because it would have seemed so obvious to most people. But today, I would argue it's not at all obvious. What I'll argue in this short presentation is that we're all being swept up in a technological revolution that threatens to undermine the very notion of liberal learning. In particular, the idea that we can substitute online learning for the essential experience of learning in a particular place and with particular people is fundamentally and deeply misguided. The question of this panel is, how do we transmit the permanent things? And I offer here a somewhat old-fashioned answer. It seems like it will only get worse. Already, you can hardly open a magazine or newspaper without being told of the impending revolution in higher education, of the great and glorious future promised by online education, and the demise of traditional universities with their bloated, staid, uncreative, tenured faculties. We're promised virtual universities that MOOCs, that ugly acronym, for those of you few who might be uninitiated, massive open online courses, that these will be salvational, and that new and radical teaching strategies propelled by technological advances will transform the broken system we have at present. The new technologists embrace these trends with abandon. We should flip the classroom, allowing students to watch a lecture at home before coming to class, where they can engage in interactive labs and teach one another instead of listening to some boring teacher drone on. After all, writes an expert from the New America Foundation, if a renowned educator gives a better chemistry lecture than Mr. Smith, then why should Mr. Smith give the lecture? Everything is undertaken in the name of excellence. There is one high standard to be achieved. Idiosyncrasy must be eliminated, and we must push relentlessly forward in our quest for better and better. Then, as Larry Arnn was saying, we can measure all of this in national standards set up by government bureaucrats based on the earnings potential exhibited by a college's graduates. The winners will be rewarded and the losers driven out. The visionaries of our time are fearless. Ambitious 38-year-olds like Ben Nelson of the internet company Snapfish tout the importance of their education reform proposals in grandiose terms. There is no better case, he observed recently in the Wall Street Journal, to do something that I can think of in the history of the world. Really, never before. I wonder about the wisdom of listening to someone whose primary claim to fame is founding an extremely successful online photo hosting site. This might remind someone of celebrities who think that because they are successful in one field, they will be great in others, such as politics or humanitarianism. That many college teachers would find this troubling is predictable. But the new technologists dismiss these objections by imputing disreputable motives. Tenured faculty members fear for their jobs, the economic objection, or they worry about the quality of their own teaching, the personal insecurity objection. The tone is relentlessly apocalyptic. If one revolution doesn't transform higher education, another will. It is only a matter of time. If students can opt for internet courses instead of the provincial and therefore inferior teaching on offer at local colleges in places like Shreveport, Cedar Rapids, and Omaha, the traditionalists had better watch out. It's better to be on the right side of history. Conform, adapt, be part of the solution. Don't resist progress. If I seem skeptical about this so-called revolution, it's true. I am deeply skeptical of it. I don't particularly care if people attribute my skepticism to economic or personal motives, which they are welcome to do. I simply think that our new technologists have misunderstood the character of true education, and particularly of liberal arts education, education at what we're calling here the permanent things, in a way that is fatal. Maybe they have forgotten, or perhaps they have never experienced the kind of education that has everything to do with particularity, with place, and ultimately, with love. Now wait, you might object from the audience. I may not be in favor of internet substitutes for the classroom, but this is altogether too romantic a statement about education. Let me try to persuade you otherwise. Not only that Eros, in the classical sense, is fundamental to education, but that without it, it becomes something else altogether, a sterile training, a form of information delivery, job preparation, or merely a hoop to be jumped through as a way of gaining the credentials to go on to the really important things that come only after graduation, once one has left the supposedly oppressive routine of college. But some of us, I think, and I imagine many of you here, maybe all of you, have had a different experience of college or university, an experience of something that was not only not oppressive, but supremely liberating. The liberation I'm talking about is not a liberation from custom and tradition, but liberation from the tyranny of the current, the up-to-date, and the pressing. The liberal education we had, if we were privileged enough to have it, opened up to us a world we could never otherwise have known, and it probably affects us deeply to this very day. So I would ask you to consider a question that is not often posed on this subject. My question is not about the content of that education, who did you read, when, in what order, but this simple question, who was it? Who was the person who introduced you to the idea or the practice of liberal education? This who question is crucial, even if it is almost always neglected. In the present day, we talk much, perhaps too much, about the intellectual substance of liberal education, posing questions like, what books should we read? Can we formulate a canon of greats? Why, indeed, should students be reading these books at all, rather than preparing for their future careers? These are, of course, important questions, but what we have failed to think about are the conditions for liberal learning to emerge, to be desired in the first place. I would argue that these conditions depend upon the deeply personal experience of finding a teacher, discovering someone who shows us and even invites us into the activity and the great tradition of liberal learning, into the tradition of the permanent things. I have heard certain education professors say that the study of the great books should simply be made mandatory. Students should be forced to it, and they will come to understand its value later. I think I understand the point here. But this approach strikes me again as an instance of someone dissatisfied with the present state of things, attempting to enforce a rule or code, a la Rousseau, we must be forced to be free. But force is not the spring of liberal education. Force turns it into yet another requirement on a long checklist that students feel obliged to complete, along with mandatory phys ed and study skills classes. The real spring of liberal education, by which I mean that kind of education one engages in for no practical outcome, for no future reward, is a vision of the thing itself. And the thing itself is exemplified in real, tangible human beings we may be lucky enough to encounter. Perhaps for you it was a high school English teacher, a woman who assigned her class Shakespeare plays to read and discuss for an entire year. Maybe it was a family friend, a bookish man who, despite his day job as a civil servant, had a rich and lively intellectual life. Perhaps it was a college professor, someone who exposed his students to Tennyson and Trollope, or to the art so foreign to our modern sensibilities of a painter like Rubens. Maybe it was a parent who read novels with gusto. It doesn't so much matter who it was as that we somewhere caught sight of a vision of learning that is, I would argue, essential for wanting to engage in it ourselves. Of course, the actual texts, that long list of greats, lie there inert and ready to be picked up. Strictly speaking, anyone can read them at any time, and if you're ready, harvest what they have to offer. But often when you pick them up by yourself, they're so daunting that you close them again in frustration and return them to the shelf. As a young college student, I had just such an experience when I attempted to read Aristotle's Politics by myself without a teacher. I undertook this project knowing the book was good for me, almost as if I were embarking on a diet and exercise routine. I made a noble but fruitless attempt before packing the book away at about page 26 next to my hand weights in the dresser drawer. The point of this story is that most of us, unless we are exceptionally gifted or precocious, require something more than abstract knowledge that great books are important. We need a particular person to tell us about a particular book or author or field of study, to demonstrate it in practice, to act as a master to whom we can apprentice ourselves. We need, in quasi-religious terms, to be evangelized. We must come to desire what we see in just the way we come to want anything else. We must have a vision of it as beautiful, as compelling, as worthy of pursuit. We must see why it is worth loving. This is why the MOOC movement is, at least at the very least for liberal learning, so fundamentally misguided. In the name of a rationalistic notion of excellence, we are asked to forego the idiosyncratic teachers we may encounter in real life in favor of a carefully and corporately packaged information delivery system that is available by design to anyone and everyone. It is explicitly not personal, but anonymous, not reciprocal, but hierarchical. The learning, such as it is, goes only one way in this model. An analogy may be drawn to religion here as a way of understanding where this movement goes wrong. If we possess some kind of religious faith, we probably recall that our faith originated in some particular person or persons, in some particular church or place. It is true that reading religious books on one's own is an integral part of faith, but it is usually not the originating experience. Instead, it was a priest, a teacher, a parent, a friend who first demonstrated the ideas and doctrines of faith to us in a living way. And so we came to hold that faith not as an abstract and perfect intellectual system, but as a practice, as a set of behaviors that we began to take part in even before we understood. We imitated like young children learning language, only eventually and gradually growing into understanding. Another analogy may be drawn to the ultimate tradition of apprenticeship, the study of classical music. When one first meets a musician, the first question is always, who did you study with? Always. No sane person would give a bit of credence to the idea of teaching music through MOOCs. Of course, anyone can watch Yo-Yo Ma give a brilliant masterclass at Juilliard, but who could seriously argue that this substitutes for our time with a teacher in a small room where we gain not from that teacher's brilliance displayed for the world, but from that brilliance focused on and oriented toward us? Indeed, the fundamental object of study is not simply the music on the page or our teacher's prowess, but on our fingers trying to play that music, to own it for ourselves. The essence of the activity is the interaction of the music, or text, student, and teacher. It is a real interaction that takes place in real, not virtual time. Why should it be any different in the study of ideas or the reading of books? I do not actually think music is so exceptional in this regard. I recently discussed these matters with a colleague, and the colleague is David Jeffrey, proposing that perhaps things are different in the sciences and in math. And if you thought his breadth and depth of learning in the humanities was impressive, he also studied physics and math as a young man. So I said to him, well, maybe in those fields you can simply absorb information without the need for a teacher like the ones I've been describing. Immediately and without hesitation, he disagreed. He said, no. He leaned forward and appeared to kind of construct a geometrical figure in the air in front of him. He said, working in the tradition of mathematics is no different at all from working in music or carpentry or cooking. What you gain in this kind of learning, apprenticeship learning, is not the bare technique of solving a problem, but rather a way of approaching it, a habit of mind, a style of thinking about the particular problem and problems like it. You gain the truly important knowledge from a master's interaction with you, not from the principles he might choose to distill into a set of instructions that could be distributed to anyone. It is not always the case that things go well in this kind of personal teaching. Just as we recall those teachers who were extraordinarily influential and inspiring, we also remember, probably just as vividly, if not more, those who pushed us away from a subject, the lecturers who were boring or positively harmful to us, the teachers who did not encourage us, those who seemed to be only going through the motions. And of course, something is lost here. But what is striking when we step back and think about all this seriously is that although we all tend to think of ourselves as the best judges of quality, we would do well to assume, as John Stuart Mill would have us do, our own fallibility. Or if you don't like Mill, as I know a lot of people here don't, we can put it in Christian terms. It is an exhortation to humility. For often what we personally need or desire from our teachers, what we judge best in others, is not what others, not even our best friends, may need and desire. What university teacher has not had the experience of hearing a student gush with praise about a professor whom he or she personally finds to be an inferior or shallow teacher? The point is that there is tremendous variability in human need, and this is what a university so nicely addresses. It offers a diversity of approach, tailored not to the one perfect student, but to the multiplicity of students who arrive with as many needs as there are human beings. The political philosopher Michael Oakeshott has put it this way in a beautiful book that I would recommend, The Voice of Liberal Learning. He says this, "A university may be credited with a power to teach which goes beyond that of its individual scholars. It is not an academy drawing its inspiration from a single preeminent man. It is a body of scholars who supply one another's imperfections, both personal and scholastic. It accommodates many different sorts of teacher, and each sort draws its power from its intercourse with other sorts. When we commend the easily articulate Don, who has a ready answer for all our questions, we should remember that he is not simply a superlatively lively mind, but is often the spokesman for the less articulate and perhaps more profound and original minds with which he is in daily communication." A university, then, is an institution peculiarly well adapted to the weakness and ignorance of mankind, because its excellence does not depend on the appearance of a universal genius, though it knows how to make room for one, should one emerge. In light of this conception of a university, I think the MOOC answer represents a kind of Gnosticism, since it implies we can remove the chance and uncertainty of human interaction by recourse to some anonymous great man or woman who can come to us by way of the internet. Clay Shirky, the famous technology enthusiast, has said this: "We ask students to read the best works we can find, whoever produced them and where, but we only ask them to listen to the best lecture a local employee can produce that morning." He's, of course, implying that the best lecturers can be quantified, approved by all, that we don't need individual human teachers in local universities to pass on an inheritance. It can all be done electronically. But this is a fundamental neglect of our embodiedness, and as I've said, a kind of Gnosticism, even a Manichaeism, as if we are all mind and no body. Just to conclude, of course, we are very much body. The attentive teacher sees our nervousness, our blushing, like Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic, when we are uncertain about what to say. In a seminar, we come to know our peers around the table as if they were members of our family. We're able to predict when the overly confident young man will make another blustering statement, or to know that the quiet young woman in the back of the room always has something to say but will not volunteer it on her own. We have learned the kinds of comments our peers will make and how our teacher, if practiced, will draw out those who need prodding, dampen conversation among those who speak too often or too confidently. The essence of our learning in classes like these comes from the conversation itself. There's a sense of sacredness in the classroom, or the lesson room, or even the science lab when its activity is what I have been describing. And this is just not something technology can provide for us. Liberal learning requires a place in actual, not virtual, reality with people we can come to know and love, and who can come to know and love us. We cannot guarantee this experience to everyone, but we can, by rejecting technology as a one-size-fits-all solution to our problems, assure that the experience still goes on for those who are fortunate enough to come to desire it. Thank you.